Yeah, welcome to Talking with the Hippies, episode 4. This is a recording I made a couple of weeks ago with a bloke I've known quite a few years, vaguely really. I just want to say, before I get into the main podcast, this really blew my mind, this recording. I wasn't ready for it at all. Totally the opposite kind of person to what I am. But beautiful, beautiful person, and let's just see what you make of it, see if it has the same effect on you, really. So, yeah, hope you enjoy it. Hi, John. Thanks for agreeing to do this, mate. It's really kind of you.
Okay, my pleasure.
I've seen you around over the last, I don't know, 30, 40 years, I suppose, off and on. We don't know each other that well, but occasionally I thought, you're an old hippie, aren't you, John? I mean, am I right there, or...?
Yeah, I guess so. It's you know, I have this thing about defining what a hippie is.
Yeah.
Because it was in California that somebody kind of said to me... about how the word hippie came around.
Oh, right.
And from their perspective, it was an old Hopi prophecy.
Yeah.
And in that Hopi prophecy, it said, there will come about a tribe of people and they will have a similar name to ourselves. And I kind of thought that was kind of cool.
Wow, that's nice, John.
You know, and it was a nice story. And I did come across reading the Hopi prophecies, quite a few things that really did I find astounding, and I've got to, you know.
So when you've grown up, we're about the same age. It's interesting because I chat with old hippies. That's what I do. One of the things I really enjoy, because I count myself as still a hippie. And my whole life I've lived according to what I feel are the rules of the hippie culture, in a way. And so I spend a lot of time thinking about it and that. When you were growing up, so it will be in the 60s, when did you first become aware of this culture that was called the hippie culture?
Well, I think... to be quite honest, that the kind of bohemian sort of culture hit me fairly early, because my uncle, who became who was my godfather, but became my uncle because he married one of my aunties, was a guy that had travelled, and he'd picked grapes in France and things like this, and he kind of turned me on to. Names, he'd drop names and tell me a little bit about this kind of the culture of the traveling people, if you like.
Yeah.
And I really loved it. I mean, I just wanted to jump on a train and be gone. And so I would say, even at the early ages of 7 or 8, I was kind of hearing stories from people that would drop into the house.
Right.
And friends of my father and my parents, or you know, but unusual people that had, and I was so excited about their stories, about what they'd done, their creative way of expressing the excitement of, you know, things, places and people that they'd met. And,
so did you come from a sort of a bohemian background then?
Well, I suppose I did, because my mum was from Ireland, and she was a great storyteller. And I was blessed with great parents, I've got to say. And my mum had what I would term as the sight. So she had a background of kind of Irish gypsy, if you like.
Yeah.
So there was that. My dad was more straighter, English, and more kind of conservative in a way. And it was very strict, firm, with a kindness as well. But I think he got pretty fucked up by the war. So, you know, we're talking
Can I want to ask you something, John, because it's blown my mind coming into your house, actually. I came in your house, it's full of artwork, which is all yours, and it's full of musical instruments. I mean, were your mum and dad that way in time?
My dad was, yeah. He, you know, I was brought up and born into a house that, you know, basically my dad, we had the piano, which was my granddad's. And my granddad was a professional music teacher, and he'd shoot off, he had, you know, my dad had like, well, the story goes, 9 sisters and a brother. So it was a big family. And they all were very musically, you know, from my grandfather. And he used to go off around the country and play concerts and stuff. You know, musicals, I should say. You know, not necessarily, but he...
But he made some living out of it.
He made his living out of teaching piano and going off. And so he was off on the road as a pianist, getting paid to perform.
Brilliant.
You know, so... And my mum comes from Wexford, and she had an amazing imagination of telling stories that always dropped me off to sleep, sort of thing. But in a way, there was always a significant sort of seed being planted there about how to be and how not to be, and going for your dream, if you like. And she was incredibly encouraging to do whatever, really. So there was an amazing amount of freedom there. My dad was on the opposite. He wanted to tie me down type thing. So it was a good complementary opposite, if you like. He was quite a hard man, I've got to say.
Right, so he wanted you to get a career and stuff.
He wanted me to knuckle down, get qualified, get to, you know, yeah, whatever it was, get an apprenticeship, get, you know, conform.
So how did that work out, John?
Oh, fuck. We fought.
Who won?
Well, I think I won. But to be honest, we both won. At some point it may transpire where I tell you when my dad died and how he died, because it was incredible. It was an incredible gift, the way he went, and me to be around that. It's a son could not wish for a greater passing of a parent. I didn't have to grieve him. We cleared, I thought we'd cleared everything years before, but on his deathbed, there was still some more to clear, and we did it incredibly well. So, and I'm glad he was as hard as he was, because if he hadn't have been, I think at times I would have found it difficult to be in situations that I had been in.
Right.
Or was going to be.
Right. Well, perhaps we'll find out more.
Yeah.
How old were you when your dad died, John?
In my 40s, 40s.
Okay, so you were well grown up.
Yeah, I was. But my mum died when I was 18.
Oh, right. Oh, wow.
And that, for me, I was 18, and it was, although my mum had been ill for a few years, she was an asthmatic, and so she'd had problems with her breathing and her heart and things like that. There was no... I was not prepared for what was to come and how I was to feel. That completely, that for me, that was a shock that I was not prepared for at all.
Right.
And it's had a big, significant change in my life.
Right.
Yeah, I was devastated.
So that would be pretty much right in the towards, well, the last...
Yeah, 68.
Yeah.
68. So, but I'd had, you know, 18 years of her guidance, if you like, mm-hmm. and her support and her kindness to, in a way, give me Yeah, give me values that.
By the eight, by when you're 18, your character must have been fairly apparent.
I was.
And what you were up to and where you were going and. Or not. I mean.
Well, I left school at 15. I couldn't read or write, and I wanted to go to art college, and there was no way because I had no qualifications, you know, and I had, there was no way. But where there's a will, there's a way. I got into printing that got me into art college. And I was incredibly fortunate, or, you know, because I don't know about, my whole life has been one of, is it destiny? Is it fate? Is it, you know, pure, you know, random luck or, you know, whatever. But my mother had implanted something about, I don't know if it's the Irish or whatever it was, you know, but she planted the thing. It was like, everything's possible and nothing's impossible. And I took that on. I took it on. I took some of my dad's stuff on as well, you know, because it's, you know, as I say, you got two people there that you're foremost, the biggest people in your life and the people around it that came in and out. My sister was a great influence. She was 4 years older than me.
Okay.
So I'm, you know, I'm 11 at 1960, but because she was 4 years older than me, I'd been listening to rock and roll and, you know, all her stuff. All her girlfriends had come round. I'm like 11 and 12 and I'm jiving with them and I'm, oh, fuck, I'm in seventh heaven. You know, the little boy, you know, six or seven girls doing the jive and I'm going, you know,
yeah,
just on the side and they're teaching me and I'm just in, you know, oh, lapping it up, you know, unbelievable. Yeah, so she was a great influence on me and music and what she was into. And but she was so different from me. Very together. She was head prefect in the school at Corpus Christi where I went. And I turned up 4 years. Well, when she left, I arrived. You know, oh, Deirdre's, you know, brother. So and they were all singing the praises of my sister because she was the blue-eyed, goody-goody type trip, you know, but, you know, in a way. And, fucking hell, that only lasted about a couple of weeks. You know, because they went, fuck, are you sure? Are you really a brother, you know? So that didn't last long. But on the school thing, the guys that I was around or friends that I'd met between me and my sister, that age group that she knew were friends, and I got to see him, you know, and one was Rick Gretsch.
Right.
And he we got confirmed together. He was a couple of years older than me. I was at Sacred Art School. We're both at Sacred Art. But somehow we were friends, you know. I don't quite know, but we always got on. And we got confirmed together. And, you know, I couldn't have been much more than seven or eight, I think, you know. So it was an early start. So I got to see him progress. And then we went to Corpus Christi. So he was there before. My sister was there before. My younger sister was 7 years. Colette was younger than me, 7 years. She went to Corpus Christi. She had to deal with what I'd left behind. But Rick became something of a mate that I got to see that actually got somewhere in the 60s with, you know, the Leicester group. The first group was the Freeners. And they did an incredible song that I brought up the other day. And it was, Stop, Let Your Conscience Be Your Guide. And I remembered that at 15 or 16. And that was, they were called the Freeners before they were called the Family. You know, with, you know, Roger Chapman and King E. I knew these guys through Rick and I knew a lot of bands through there. So on the music scene in the 60s, oh my goodness me, was unbelievable. Because I used to hang out, all my mates were from, a lot of them were from school, around sport, football and whatever, all around Leicester. But they were all kind of into music as well. So there was a place called the El Rondo. What the people that were turning up there, and I was right into the blues, was, you know, John Lee Hooker and things. Now, I was playing harmonica at the age of 12, you know. I mean, and I was pretty damn good by 15. Because I used to drive my dad mad by having it under the sheets and playing my harmonica. And he'd come in at 1 o'clock in the morning saying, if you don't shut up, I'm going to, you know. So, and I got to go on stage with John Lee Hooker.
Wow.
You know, and I was, I don't know, at the time, probably about 16. And, you know, there was a whole thing there with the Stones and Van Morrison and the Blues and all them. They were right into it. And I don't know if you know about it, but they were the guys, Clapton and, but mostly Keith Richards, I think, was a big influence in this. Of bringing all these old blues guys around to do a tour in Britain. Now, I kind of heard about this, and they came to them on the tour. We're talking about Big Bill Bruzy. These guys were like, for me, were like, fuck, you know, Sonny, Terry, Brown, and McGee, you know, I'm going, you got to be joking, you know. And I didn't have the money to go, so I used to break in everywhere, the clubs and things. If I didn't have the bread, I'd get in somehow, you know, the cheeky little fucker. And the Montfort Hall was a big place. And I remember getting up into the rafters, getting in the back, climbing through a window with a few mates to see these guys looking down on the stage and juggling, our, you know. So, and that was set for life. And in the coffee bars around there was... this is when, in a way, the 60s began for me, because even around, you know, 13, 14, I was hanging out in the coffee bars listening to Bob Dylan, Joan Baez, and they just blew my mind. Bob Dylan, for me, was like, what the first time I heard it. And then, of course, you'd hear, you know, Woody Guthrie and people that had influenced him, and it was just all, it was right up my street.
Yeah.
And I remember bunking off from school because I heard about these beatniks. Now, this is way, I don't even know how old it was. It was about 12 or something, 14. And I just heard about it down in Cornwall. And of course, who's down there, but these people living on the beach in a kind of cave kind of situation on the beach. And that, so that was my first introduction of getting shagged, if you like.
Right.
Because they were, you know, it was an older hippie girl, and I was like a young buck, and I was taken in hand, if you like, more, you know, and so shown the way, you know.
Sean, I'm going to... I've kind of got a bit of an agenda here, but I'm going to abandon it, mate, because one of the things about the hippie scene for me that always eluded me was this free love thing. And I, you know, and there you are, a young lad, and you've walked right into it. I mean, was this commonplace in your life, or was this just a one-off?
Well, it wasn't a one-off, Tom, and I don't know why, because it
maybe
wasn't...
Maybe you were more handsome, or maybe you were...
No, I don't know. I mean, I just don't know how I get in these situations, or get out of them, it seems like it's absolutely nothing to do with me, to be honest, you know. I mean, you know, because it was... It's out of innocence or naivety or just plain not caring about the consequences, because I didn't give it much thought. It was like, oh, here I am, and this is what you do, or this is what's done. So it's kind of like, it's like going to the circus and going, wow, isn't this amazing? So there was still some, and I thank my mum for this, there was still some kind of innocence about, or naivety about the world that I lived in. So the fantasy and the hippie trip just like right up my street, mate. This is fucking made for me. This is my time. I don't know where I'm going. I don't care where I'm going. And my mum, you know, she said, I remember overhearing her say things like, John doesn't have a care in the world. And that's the way he is. You know, and somebody was, don't you think he should be this, doing this and that? And my mum was like, no, he's all right. He's fine. He'll make his way. You know, he's doing okay.
John, let's go back to that, the music thing, because you were hanging around these guys. Was there ever a point in your life where you thought, maybe this is how I can make a living?
Yes, yeah, there was. I mean, and I did kind of get into some groups. And I guess, you know, my ego really wanted to be the singer, because I was impressed by Van Morrison and these guys that could just sing in such a passionate, beautiful way that just would bring me to tears, but move me. I was moved by the music, and that's it. I was moved by the music.
So I just feel like, because I don't have any musical skill or whatever, I love music, but I can't do it. I watch, like, now I've got a nephew who's quite good at music, and he's obsessed. And I'm guessing that if you want to make it in that business, that's kind of how you've got to be. If you're a bit scattered, you're probably not going to get there unless you're super talented.
Well, it was really interesting because, so the music was in our family. Every Christmas, the house was full. And they would come over from Ireland, and I had uncles that played the harmonica, which turned me onto the harmonica. My mum's brother played harmonica with the Bachelors, because the Bachelors set off an Irish group. And all three of them, three brothers, played harmonica. And my uncle played with them. He played good harmonica. So as a kid going over to Ireland at a very early age of, I don't know, we used to go every second, third year, you know. I'd listen to him play going, fuck, how does he do that? And of course he gave me one. And I never, you know, but then I heard one boy, Sonny Terry Brown McGee, and it was a harmonica, just harmonica, doing this train. And it, and I went, oh, and that was it. But there's one harmonica player, oh my God, that was it. Yeah. I was done. Yeah. So then it was like, I went down, bought myself a fairly decent harp. Actually, I didn't. I bought this old tin, cheap Chinese one, but I got to play on that, and then I progressed. And then Bob Dylan playing the harp and
yeah.
You know. But music, oh, okay. So when I did get to art college, Jimi Hendrix, you know, Jimi Hendrix experience, the Animals, the Kinks, the Who, the blah 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 blah, were all playing in Leicester. And around Midlands. Well, a couple of my mates would be out every night because there were roadies with the, one of them was a roadie with Jimi Hendrix Experience. And they'd come back. I mean, I couldn't get to all of them because, you know, it was like, but they were getting a bit of money to, I don't know how they did it, but they were turning me on to, you've got to see these guys, you know. Not just the names of the ones that became famous, but there was a lot of, and they're all on the same bill, or they'd all jam at the end of the dinner. there's one story here that kind of changed that. So my first week, and this is hippie, because my first week of work, leaving school at 15, the day that I start, of all the days to start, was April Fool's Day, and it was fucking, so I'm going, you gotta be fucking, and that was an omen. It wasn't meant for me to work, I wanted to play, I just wanted to play all my life, little playboy. And anyway, so I started work on April Fool's Day, blah, blah, blah. And at the end of the week, I get my first wage packet, but it was fucking peanuts, a couple of quid. I was in them, And and my mum said, go down the pub and, because I was going in the pub at 14, 15, even at school, we're drinking pints, blah, blah, blah. She says, go down and with some of your mates and have a drink. I went. I came back and I'd never come back drunk to my house. I wouldn't. That's not my scene. I never shit on your own doorstep, and don't let anybody else shit on your doorstep, was the attitude that I had. Anyway, I came in, I walked through the living room door, right? And my dad cracked a fucking chair on my back, on my head. And I was down on the deck and I looked up and went, what the fuck is that about? And I was in shock and I was kind of, it hurt, and I was kind of tearful. But the shock was, what have I done? What was that? And he says, don't you ever come back drunk in here. And I'm going, fuck, I'm not drunk. And it was like, and I got up and I says, and I point to him, I says, you ever fucking hit me again and I'll fucking kill you. I meant it.
So, John, you're growing up in this wild world, really.
Yeah.
And the reality of having to, I don't know if it hit you or not, but for me it was like, well, I've got to find some way through here. How am I going to make some money, for example?
Yeah.
Or did you just wing it totally?
Well, I was earning peanuts, and all my mates was 3 or 4 years older than me. I was the youngest out of the team, if you like, soccer and all the rest of it, And I had a few different packs of that I didn't really run with a pack, but I had some friends that was earning money illegally.
Right.
Okay.
Doing
the things that were being done by then. So some were pushing pills.
Yeah.
Some was, a dope would come into the scene.
Yeah.
And I was at times, and also there was villains. Basically, I didn't really look at them as villains, but they were robbing, not robbing people, but robbing warehouses. And warehouses where there was some good hippie clothes, which was one that we did one time.
Okay.
And it was the shop in Leicester called Irish Linen. And they had Ben Sherman shirts and fucking all the gear and that. And it's like, and so we couldn't afford any of that. So somebody had a good idea. I mean, you'd go and lift a shirt or try and sneak something out on your own. And somebody, was one step up on that shelf and said, fuck it, let's do it, let's go and fucking raid the place and we can have as many shirts as blah blah blah. So there was a part of me that was running with different kind of groups. There was the music group, there was the sports group, there was knowing the villains and the townies. Now the townies were old school fighters and villains and robbers, and a lot of people looked up to them because they feared them. So I was in on the townie scene, and these guys were like, you know, they were in and out of jail and all kinds of things. You know, I mean, the stories are wild. And for me, coming up with these stories about these guys that lived around our local, you know, lived around different estates and that. And these were old boys, you know, so I'm 16 and they're 30s, and they should have had more mentality, but they weren't. That was their mentality. You know, it was that's how they lived. And it didn't take me long to be not really impressed by that sort of shit, but I was in it and around it. And I did do some, you know, for me, breaking in to see a concert at the Leicester University, that's something that we did as one team, because we, you know, if we could get in or get round the backstage. Mm. And of course, I knew people who was involved with the bands and things like that. So we used to get in a lot of for freebies and so on. You know, that's kind of... But some of the things that happened, we became legendary in Leicester. And some I was involved with, you know, that were really quite funny. Because once again, like you're saying, or asked by accident, I find myself in the most ridiculous situations, and without even trying or wanting it, I ended up with a reputation of like, don't fuck with this guy, which I played that persona out to a degree, you know. So I had all these personas. And I didn't know who the fuck I was in any of them. You know, that's the truth. You know. One, for instance, that became kind of a bit legendary is I'm up on the local pally had a balcony all the way around and then a stage and then the dance floor. Well, the band was playing. I can't, you know, some band, local band was playing. Everybody's rock and roll and jiving and all the rest of it. And I'm up on the top there with a couple of the lads, and we're larking about, right? And the next minute, I lost my balance and fell over the balcony. So I don't know how high it was, but it was, I guess it must have been about 15 feet. You know, about that, I guess. Anyway, down below me, unbeknown to me, was about five or six of these townies. Lammy. Moose, all these, you know, Tambo, all the guys that are the fucking townies, you know. And I was this like 15, 16 year old. And I fell, I'm diving onto these and I landed on them and I took them out. So, and I'm on top of one of these guys and I'm trying to get up. Well, he's out, cold. And the other ones are just scattered around because I fell on their heads. They were all kind of grouped together. Of course, everybody sees this. And I get up and I'm sort of like this, staggering around, thinking, fuck, what happened there? My mates are fucking going, holy fuck. They're looking down going, fuck me, out of all the people to fall on, you do not want to fall on these guys. So, of course, everybody looks around going, fuck. Hey, who is this guy? This, you know, this buck, you know, this young, you know. And I'm kind of shaking myself going, fuck. And they're looking at me. These guys are stunned. I'm fucking stunned. Anyway, I looked around and I was like, fuck, you know. And I didn't leg it. I walked away. Of course, the stories were, this guy dives off the fucking balcony onto these guys and knocks them out and fucking does them in and walks away. Cool as you like. So, you know, next thing is my mates are saying, fuck me, mate, you got fucking guys coming for you, you know. And anyway, the stories go on.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
And I'm going, well, some fucker's got to tell him it was just a fucking, you know, accident. You know? Anyway, you know. But this is the kind of thing that seemed to either follow me or open up. And round the drug scene, same thing. I get, you know, I'm in Miami, I'm in California, I'm in these, and I end up in parties. And the next minute, you know, somebody's lending me this I'll take my car, you know. And I'm not talking about just an ordinary car. I'm talking about fucking Mustang, fucking Sally. And as if I'm in with the in crowd. Because I'm a limey, you know, I'm young, I seem to not care a fuck about anything. I got a few quid in my pocket. I was doing crazy things without really... I wasn't really doing crazy. I was just being me. And then getting offered, you know, hey, you know, would you do this? Take this boat to so-and-so. Deliver this boat for me. Deliver the boat and you can have the boat. Afterwards. You know, and a boat worth a lot of money.
Okay, we're going to start part two with a song from John.
This is a song that I wrote recently. I'd like to play it for you.
What would I give to have
between your stories of when you were in Leicester,
yeah,
and suddenly we're in LA. Can you just briefly fill us into that, how that happened? I mean, obviously that's a huge ask, but
it is. Okay, I'll give you a brief. So I basically I was on a boat in Monte Carlo, 1969.
How did that happen, John?
I got a lift, I was hitchhiking, I didn't know where I was going, I had no destiny, got hitchhiked. And I got picked up in a Volkswagen with two South African guys. They were heading to Monte Carlo, so I went with them. They were not staying there, they were taking off. So, and they went into, I'm not even 21, but to go into the casino, you had to have a tie, you had to be 21. I didn't have a tie. But anyway, we got in. And that was the night, for me, where I overcame all my gambling as regards to gambling in the casino. What I saw there was shocking. It really, I'd been through all the gambling stuff before with darts and cards and things like that, blah, blah, blah. I knew how to gamble and whatever. But that was the shocking. I got in. Now, and I didn't particularly have any dress. I was hitchhiking, man. I had a few hippie clothes and things, but I had something, and I borrowed a tie from them, and I borrowed something from them to look a little bit smarter. We got in. Now, there's three rooms in the Monte Carlo Casino. Your first room is probably just your ordinary punters. The second room is like your bit high rollers. Your third room is your fucking top boy high rollers, your Frank Sinatras and things like that. Now, you can't normally just go in. Now, I don't know how I did this, but somehow I just walked in. Bluffed. I didn't even bluff. I was curious. And that curiosity got me in and out of all kinds of things. But I found myself in the third room. Now, it was fairly empty, you know. There wasn't, I don't know, there couldn't have been 10 people in the whole room. But there was one couple that I went over to, because that's where the action was. There was, one couple, wasn't it? And there was nobody around them. So, in fact, they might have been the only people there. And I'm walking in just, And what I saw changed a lot for me. So I looked, I had a few chips, and I looked at when I was stacking these chips, and I looked at these chips and I went, you've got to be fucking joking. This is 1969. They were putting down something in the region of 20,000 to 25,000 pounds. And I looked at it, I'm going, what the fuck? She had a whole load of spy equipment. There must have been about 50 or 60. There were, 60s. They weren't young, yet. She had all these sparkers around her, obviously very wealthy. And the face of them, like fucking miserable. Yeah, there was nothing there. There was nobody home. They weren't enjoying themselves. They weren't really happy. They were just kind of making, I don't know what they were doing. And I looked at these pair and I looked at what, and I remember distinctly going, fucking hell. One roll of the roulette table that they'd obviously paid for the night to have, one roll was more than my dad had earned the whole of his life. And every probably would, And I just, something just sank and went, fuck me. But that, I remember, walking out of there. But before I walked out, one minute I had a whole load of chips. The next minute, I'm down to one. And I tossed it, and I put that down and lost that. And I thought, fuck me. I've only been left a, a couple of weeks. I'm fucking broke. I've skint. I didn't have a pot to piss in. No job. No, these guys are fucking off with their Volkswagen. And I'm stuck there sleeping out in the fucking. And, the next morning, I looked around, looked at the yachts, and I went, fuck, I woke up and went, I got to get a job. But I wasn't deterred. I felt kind of free, to be honest. And it was kind of exciting. I'm like, right, now we're going to see what you're up for to make your way through the world, because that's what I wanted to do. I thought I could, and I wouldn't. And I went on, and I picked the biggest boat called the Morella that was owned by this Robert D. Bulgani. I didn't know that. People in the yachting world, crew, were waiting for years to get on this boat. I walks up, says, he got any, could have a start, have you got any, And I got on. I spoke to the captain. I went, kind of see the captain. Next minute I'm in front of the captain. He says, you done any boating? You got any experience? I said, and I bullshitted. And I said, the only place I could think of was Southampton. I said, from Southampton sort of thing. Didn't say Leicester, middle of fucking. And he says, that's interesting. He says, that's okay. We're not far apart. And I'm from Gosport. And I went, I didn't even fucking heard of Gosport. But anyway, I ended up getting on. He says, you start tomorrow. When I went on there, the bosun, I went up to him and said, I come clean. I went, because I ain't going to, I says, look, I don't know my arse from my elbow. I don't know nothing about boats. I'm from Leicester, but I'm willing to graft and work, And he says, okay, Now, this guy was Alex. He'd been on the Royal Yacht Britannia for 20 years. He'd been in the Royal Navy before that. He was an old sea dog. And he took me on board and, showed me a bit of rights, but... sorry, I've digressed.
Oh, so where did you go on that boat?
So the next minute, for me, I'm like, fuck, this boat, was like, I don't believe it. I'm on a job. that, you know, millionaire chef, the owner's not on board, you know, the food was like, and I've been fucking starving for 2 weeks, you know, I couldn't believe it. I'd landed, you know, in a bucket of, you know, bucket of shit and come out smelling roses. So I'm going, fuck, I'd be campo. And the next week, we're going to the West Indies, the Caribbean. I'm going, fuck me. You know, I mean, talk about land on your feet. That, to me, was like, oh, my God. You know.
So that got you over to the other side of the Atlantic.
That got me to crossing the Atlantic,
yeah,
and going to the Caribbean. I spent my 21st in Guadeloupe, the French West Indies. And that's when I first saw a whole pot, and I went to the market on my birthday. My 21st birthday was a big day as well for me. I wanted to celebrate my 21st. And the cookie gave me some, says, here's some money, get a list of things, I'll make you a cake, I'll sort out, we'll have a party tonight. I went out, fucking blew the lot in the pub, in a shack. Blew the lot, got pissed out of my box. This was in the morning. Ended up in the gutter. I could not fucking move. I was on the moonshine of the Guadeloupe. Dangerous place to be, in the gutter, not being able to move. I had my senses, but I could not lift my arm. And it went from daylight to darkness. 1 minute I'm singing The Wild Colonial Boy in the pub, and they're all looking at me in, you know, French West Indies, you know, they don't understand a word. I walked out the door, I'd never been hit like this ever before, and I'd never ever been that drunk ever since. I walked out and bang, it was like I was hit with a bolt, but prior to that, one of the guys, Tom, who's from California, Tom Borges, one of the top surfers in the world, next to Nat Young, who was the top guy from Australia, and I got to know, you know. So Tom was one of my mates on this boat. He was just decking. We went out, went to the marketplace, and somehow he had to get back to the boat, and I went off to try and get some food for my cake, and ended up in this shack. But we're in the marketplace, and I looked at this, there was an old lady there, must have been about, I don't know, fucking, no teeth, you know, she's about 60. And she's sitting in front of all this bush. And I looked at her and I went, fuck me, Tom, is that, you know, is that what I think it is? He says, it surely is. I said, fucking hell. You know, so she had this great pile of fucking bush. So I said to her, you know, how much for, you know, for some of that? And she said $5, you know. And I said, you know, $5, you know, for the whole fucking lot. I'm going, what? Tom looked at me, I looked at him, we went, happy fucking days. You know, I mean, it was, I'm talking about four foot across, easy, and 3 foot high. $5. Tom took the fucking lot, of course. And, yeah, so, I mean, but that was my first of the West Indies. Now, we went right down to South America, to Trinidad, Tobago, and then down to Venezuela. We went up to Miami. I was smuggling. Moonshine. And not white lightning, but basically some straight stuff, because it was Mount Gay rum. So I was taking rum up there, knowing that we're going to Miami. And somebody says, you take this to Miami, man, one bottle is worth three times as much, blah, blah, blah. So I went, fucking happy days for me. I had a crate of that, get to Miami, no problem selling, you know. And then the other stuff. So, you know, that was my first easy peasy. Now, I never bought dope ever in my life. And this is gospel's honor. I never bought dope. I never smuggled dope. So I never paid for it. I partake and I partook of, you name it, everything. Peyote, fucking mush, you know, you name it. Acid. And I was around stuff, as you know a little bit already, around all this, to the point of big time. Big time. Now, I got offered a lot of things. I got offered a lot of, to do a lot of things. Now, I don't know if it was my mom's seeds, but I always felt that was not for me. A lot of my friends have, you know, been homegrown since fucking the 60s and still are in Wales and all over the UK and other parts of the world, Spain, wherever, you know.
John, this is an absolutely wild life you've had.
Mm, yeah, yeah.
I really wasn't expecting this at all. I knew you were a colourful character. This reminds me of something out of Jack Kerouac book or something like that.
Well,
you know,
I got to meet some of these people.
You know, I mean, it's I'm speechless, really, John. I'm supposed to be asking you questions, and I'm just thinking, Jesus, I just don't even know where to start.
I don't really, you know, to be honest.
Let me just have a little look, see if any of what I've written down is at all relevant here.
I'm not even telling
me there about the what. So you didn't do the smuggling because you got picked up with something from your mother. Let me just say that.
Yeah. Okay, I was on a boat, right, and I crewed a boat. And I was told we were taking stuff from the Hook of Holland, and the boat was called the Bearham. We came out from there, went from Rotterdam to Hook of Holland, went from Holland to Belgium, and then so the idea that I knew, that I thought, me and a buddy from Manchester, I thought we were taking chassis to Tampa on this boat. It was a cargo boat, right? Big motherfucker. I was taking cargo to Tampa, right? It turns out we were taking a lot more, and I didn't realize. I honestly didn't realize, but I found out once we'd left. Okay, this story is, you know, it's a true story.
Let me just ask you this first, John. I should probably shouldn't have interrupted you there, because you don't lose the thread of
no,
that, John.
No, that's the story.
When I was a freak in my young days, and there were drugs, and I was involved, and we knew that to a certain level we were dealing with other hippies.
Yeah.
And, you know, but we knew that if we went beyond that, we would start dealing with people that weren't very nice.
That's right. Yeah.
And so we were really, well, we were scared shitless of going beyond it, and we would always stay in our little level.
Sure.
And yet you're out there clearly brushing up against all kinds of people that are serious criminals, really. Is that true?
I mean, Mr. Nice, all that stuff.
Yeah.
Okay, I met him.
But he was all right, wasn't he, as a person, or not?
Well,
I mean, we're running out of time here, John, but
sorry,
was he all right? I mean, in his book, he comes across as quite a nice person.
No, that's a great image that he put out and puts there. But I got to see stuff. I mean, the people he was around, fuck me, man, we're talking heavy fucking duty. So I went to a party in Miami, in Florida. It was in Florida, it was in Miami. Now, I was in Miami Beach. I was working. I painted the sets for One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Ken Kesey. And I was doing that at the time that this kind of the whole thing happened. I got invited. I was invited to parties. I was with around bikers. My girlfriend was a biker at the time, came from Detroit. They'd worked for 8-9 months, make a shitload of money, come down, and then it was loads of cocaine. I was having more fucking cocaine than I could fucking put, you know, it was unreal, unreal. There's a story around that. Anyway, so we go to this party, Mr. Nice, and Mr. Fucking Ugly and all the rest of it. They were some, and IRA, there was people there that were into like using drug money to arm and disarm and people, you know. It was like, but the sense, when you went into this party, it was like, thanks, but no thanks. But I'm meeting these people. So he had a nice veneer. But come on, man. I mean, you're fucking up people.
Didn't you ever sort of feel like, fuck me, I need to get out of this?
Yes. And the thing is, I did. And then I find myself in another movie. It was like, this was, my life was like a pantomime. I'd go from this day, and then the next week I'm in this thing, and then the next minute I'm in this, and the next minute I'm on this boat, next minute I'm going over here. It was fucking like a roller coaster. But somehow, and I was working illegally there, you know.
But you weren't a criminal, were you?
No.
You'd
no, not in my in my mind, and still to this day, I'm not saying I was.
Not that I'm not passing a moral judgment on criminals. I'm just saying that you kept just out of it.
I did, yeah.
And somehow you were accepted on that scene as one of the lads, or were there other people in the same situation as you, or were just kind of the.
Well, my buddy, who was my sidekick, if you're a good mate of mine, he'd bring me up and said, oh, we're straight deal, you know. He ended up doing time for smuggling from New York to London. He did one. I hadn't seen him for years, and then somebody says, do you know where Duffy is? Now, it wasn't his real name, but we called him Duffy. At this time, all through the 60s, and well, not through all through the 60s, but 69 to 79, I was blue. Was one of the names that I used because I was working illegally. I worked under the Panamanian flag, the Monrovian flag, blah, blah, blah. I was working in all these countries, legally on the boat, on some of the boats, but illegally when I wasn't on the boats, doing painting boats, paint, you know, do whatever jobs, you know. Delivering cars, you know, doing things. So there's a lot of, all through this, from leaving Leicester to today, there's still a straight line right the way through Wales when the Operation Julie, there's this line from my first certificate that I ever got, was cleanly, from birth certificate to now, is a straight line where nothing can touch. Johnny Allen, if you know, the straight guy that's worked here, but there's, in them 10 years, there's gaps where there is no record at all of where I was, what I was doing, who I was with, and how I was earning my living or anything. There's a straight line. My family know that, but they also know...
John, I met you, I don't know when, not that long ago, really, to this stuff.
No.
But you're a peace-loving guy, I like you because you've got a big heart, and you know what's right, and yet you've come through the most amazing adventures, and you've sailed so close to the wind. Yeah. I mean, did you get to a point where you just thought, oh, better just quit.
Let me just tell you a few things here. Now, I ended up in jail in Marbella. I've ended up in few jails where you do not want to fucking be. In the middle of Africa, I ended up in jail. Right? Did I want to be in that situation? No, the fuck did I want to be in that situation? How I got there, I'm going, whoa. And I've got to tell you, this peace-loving part of me that was searching for me in all this, found himself like, holy fuck, how did I get it? And how am I getting out? And I'm going, and I've got to tell you, I'm just giving you this, I've always, in my heart of hearts, there is this part of me that believes that a human being can live in peace and live with others in peace. It wasn't me. Music was one thing, but the stuff around music I've seen a lot of friends through the misuse and abuse of drugs, alcohol, sex, all these things that I thought was a so-called successful human being. It wasn't. And so the process has been, that's kept that line somewhere from the values that I learned from my parents and the people that were around me at the beginning, I'm happy to say. But what I got to see somewhere, somehow, there's been I've been carried through all this diversity and deepest, darkest holes with a lot of pain, a lot of pain. But a part of me has gone, hang about. The first Band the Bomb fucking marches that I did with Bertrand Russell and all that stuff, we were going, Sister Anna carried the banner. And half the guys were hitting fucking cops and everybody else with the banners, with peace on it, and the peace sign. And I'm going, no, you know, it's not right.
Okay, there we are, episode 4 of Talking with the Hippies. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, please share. Please register your interest to hear about new episodes. And please tell your friends. Thank you so much for listening.